Thank you for listening to this podcast from TRE, Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain and around the world. For more information, please visit tre.radio.
En Camino with Kit Hogg.
Hello and welcome to a brand new edition of En Camino, coming to you live on Talk Radio Europe this Saturday, the 13th of June. And today we are en route, journeying from the UNESCO heritage icon of the Mosque of Cordoba to the world's tallest church, the staggering Sagrada Familia in Barcelona. We say hello to a cowboy called P.I., the proposition of a tunnel linking Spain with Morocco, and appropriate to these turbulent times in which we live, discover the most peaceful place on the planet. Plus, if I was to say to you a whole bunch of hassle for a fleeting moment of pleasure, would I be referring to a trip to IKEA, the bipolar tendencies of a mercurial marriage, a 1970s British sports car? No, actually, I'm talking about my swimming pool.
En Camino with Kit Hogg.
Yeah, so thanks to Giles Brown for his inimitable breakfast show and for getting the aircon to work. Actually, he didn't get the aircon to work, but he's left me with a fan, which is sitting on the chair next to me. So, yeah, very refreshing. Thanks, Gilesy. Now, I wonder, have you ever lived close by a wonder of the world must-see attraction and just not bothered with it? On the basis that it's always going to be there and you can save it for another day. Well, back in England, we used to live in a town called Bath. You've probably heard of Bath. It's in Somerset. Did we ever go and see the World Heritage Roman Baths, after which the city is named? No, we didn't. Maybe now we don't live in the vicinity, I'll make the effort to go as a tourist. But to break this mould of complacency, some weeks ago I went to Cordoba to visit the globally famous Mezquita, the mosque. I'd made two previous attempts to see this place, but like a lot of destinations these days, you can't just turn up. Such is the crush of modern tourism, even in Cordoba during the month of March, that you need to book on the internet, which, in an unusually organised way, I did. All set, then. Third time lucky, on a cultural jolly with visiting family. We arrived in Cordoba by train, stepping out of the railway station into a rather disconcerting expanse of paving and concrete, like an overblown military parade ground, disproportionately bordered by Stubby 60s low-rise blocks, suggestive of something Soviet, but more likely a legacy of Franco. Anyway, apparitions of totalitarianism fade as you wend your way through a leafy linear park, the green lungs of the Ville Nouvelle Cordoba, which terminates in a castellated Medina wall, the other side of which is pure time travel. The preserved world of the ancient Jewish quarter, narrow streets and patio gardens. There's nothing immediately Jewish about the Jewish quarter now. They were moved on by Fernando and Isabella 500 years ago. Today, the barrio is saturated with tourist shops, splattered with tourist tat, dangling in doorways, and of course, tourists themselves, who were, on this occasion, posses of bored French teenagers, posturing inane gangster poses for selfies. We elbowed our way through them to the main attraction, the mosque. La Mezquita de Cordoba is so highly regarded that it keeps getting promoted to the next division of the planet's most unmissable attractions. In 1984, it was elevated from National Monument to UNESCO World Heritage Site. And then 3 years ago, the mosque gained promotion again, this time to the rarefied Super League of Sites of Outstanding Universal Value. If there's one thing you probably know about the Mosque of Cordoba, it is that it's no longer a mosque, because when the Christians arrived, they plonked a cathedral on top of it. Which is to say, they flattened a large central section comprising exquisite cream and terracotta arches of beguiling austerity and impeccable symmetry to make way for a Roman Catholic temple of questionable taste, topped off by a 45-metre dome, St. Peter's style. Over the past 500 years, much has been written about this so-called desecration. There's been trumpeting triumphalism, soul-searching, and beating of breasts. Because even today, presented as it is, as a miracle of two faiths, a coexistence of juxtaposed art and architectures, a site of outstanding universal value indeed, unless you're a Roman Catholic so blinkered as to hanker for the return of the Spanish Inquisition. That's a bit unkind, but you get my drift. It's impossible to leave the Mesquita without the impression that the plonking of the cathedral transept into the middle of it represents an act of bizarre and calculated vandalism on a colossal scale, which in itself is mind-bending, fascinating, and absolutely why, even if you're not in the habit of visiting old buildings, you should frequent this one. Get a guide. It's worth it. The random nature of the place is bewildering enough as it is. You need a man or a woman with a plan. We rendezvoused with her at 1:30 p.m. by the olive tree next to the fountain in the plaza. She was an enthusiastic soul in thick glasses, handing out mysterious plastic red boxes the size of mobile phones, which you hang around your neck on a cord. Also provided is a blue cable earpiece, which, once plugged into the dangling red box and inserted in your ear, enables you to hear her commentary given via a microphone around her neck. This high-tech guiding, but I promptly dropped my device, which sprang apart, red plastic on ancient cobbles. Unable to receive her broadcast, I had to stand unnaturally close to her in an unmenacing way in order to apprehend the information that she was dispensing. But like a good guide, she took this indication of fanatical interest in her stride, and we tailed her as she dove into the 8th century, the world of the Mesquita, a still subterranean atmosphere of myriad arches, striped, upturned horseshoes supported on a plantation of identical columns. Originally, 1,293 of them in a square kilometre, the greatest mosque of its day, and even today, the fourth largest on earth. No centre, no altar or edifice around which to clamour or orientate, devoid of any imagery but nasal stimulus, which was the clean tang of simmering tea tree oil incense. Vaulted arch after vaulted arch under cedar ceilings in wine-coloured light and shadow, mind-emptying and mesmerising. Author Michael Jacobs says of the mosque that it reflects a mentality that has no belief in priestly hierarchy and sees no need to have any rigid structural format in a place of worship. The centre of the mosque is where you are, anywhere in the building that you want to pray. And in its day, up to 20,000 believers prayed here at one time. As our group was herded good-naturedly through the not-quite-impersonal columns, each one was imperceptibly signed in Arabic by the stonemason who had built it, suddenly change was in the air. Emerging from the dark arches as one would arrive, at a clearing in a forest, we found ourselves in the environs of the blinkingly bright cathedral. From Santiago de Compostela to Sevilla to Palma de Mallorca, I've been to great Spanish cathedrals, but nothing prepared me for this. It was like being inside a vast and indigestible sherry trifle of soiled creams, custard pinks, and purple fruits made from stucco, plaster, and carved stone. Trumpeting cherubims in gold, silver, bronze, and brass, lecterns, altars, an organ of 5,600 pipes, and a massively ornate choir stall begun in 1748 by the 69-year-old Pedro Duque out of black Cuban mahogany. Pedro died as he finished the work 15 years later and rests here in the transept itself, almost as if he expired on the job and they buried him with due sanctity there and then. The Renaissance brocade of the transept walls are hung with paintings of celestial saints and martyrs surfing the clouds in swirling skies as they ascend towards salvation and the awaiting Almighty. Whereas the mosque and its arches are dark and muted, because the cupola dome is an immense skylight, the cathedral and its artefacts glitter and shine relentlessly, bathing in a light quite startling. No hiding place here. There's no solemnity of shadow or glade, no softening or escape from this Baroque extravagance at its most bloated. But lest I seem harsh on the Christian modifications to the place, let's bear in mind three things. Firstly, the Christians were here first. Yes, the Visigoths worshipped in a church, the Basilica of San Vicente, on the very site of the Mesquita in the 7th century, 100 years before the Muslims even set foot in Iberia. Second, the Reconquista was a haphazard and monumental struggle by Christians reclaiming Christendom in an attritional crusade that lasted over 500 years. Triumphs were victories for the Christ, and as such, Allah would pay the price in mosque conversions. Cordoba was but one of these, and in spite of the religious fervour of the Reconquista, there was actually a surprising sensitivity and visible expressions of regret over the changes to the Mesquita, even as early as the 16th century, from none other than the Holy Roman Emperor, Charles V himself. Finally, as our tour guide bade us farewell, she stressed that had the Christians not emphatically moved in, the building that today is a site of outstanding universal value may, in the interim, may well have been abused and ruined, used as a prison or a polygono, died of neglect, and that this mosque owes its salvation to the fact that at its centre, there is now a church. The Cathedral Mosque of Cordoba is surely unique, not only its vivid history, its juxtaposition of architectures, but what it shows us about two great global faiths. No contrast that I know of indicates quite so clearly the disconnect between the antecedent idolatry of Catholicism and the empty, impersonal space of Islam. One space where you approach God via martyrs, saints, a virgin, and a saviour, and another where, starkly, there's just him and you.
En Camino with Kit Hogg.
Sorry about that. Rudely interrupted by the adverts there. When just as I was talking about Gaudi and the Sagrada Familia. Anyway, yes, as you probably know, the Pope was there on June the 10th to inaugurate the tallest of the towers. And the church is actually almost, it is within sight of completion. The downside of La Sagrada Familia is the conflict between the cathedral and its neighbours across the street. which is an issue that resurfaces cyclically whenever the temple's completion is deemed to be approaching. The construction of the controversial Portal de la Gloria, which is a big avenue that approaches the cathedral. I don't know if you... I'm going to stop talking about cathedrals in a moment, don't worry. But Spanish cathedrals, they're very often hemmed in by what surrounds them. Thinking of Granada particularly, and Seville, you can't sort of stand back and actually admire their facade. But Gaudi took care of that because... He apparently had plans for a grand avenue and a staircase that leads to the front of the building, so you can just be totally awed by it. And the residents now claim, the residents who live in the blocks that are due to be demolished for this vista, for the Portal de la Gloria, for the approach to the Sagrada Familia, the residents claim that that was never part of Gaudi's original plan, because quite understandably, it would entail the demolition of their homes, at least 100 apartments, to clear the way for this grand approach. So there's a bit of a controversy going on, which one feels that with Catalan reasonableness will be sorted out. There are actually three alternative proposals on the table, ranging from the radical to the more compensatory. And one feels that a compromise will be reached humanely. Watch this space. Anyway, it's not about to be finished soon. I would imagine, well, I'm 72. I wouldn't have thought it'd be finished in my lifetime. But still worth a visit. It's a magnificent church. The tallest church in the world. Right, that's enough about churches. I'm not going to talk about any more churches, I promise you. If you were listening last week, you might have heard our feature, Hell Hath No Fury. Like a woman's rage. Do I need to say that? Why British women are the angriest in Europe. That was our feature last week. The issues stem from pregnancy, motherhood, menopause, and societal pressure. And the societal stuff is a lot to do with how women feel treated by men. Illustrated graphically by Janie last week, who waxed lyrical and vented eloquently on the antics of her ex-husband. By way of reply, by way of contrast, I thought it would be interesting to juxtapose the feminine viewpoint with a male one. It's an excerpt, this reading that I'm going to read you, from a novel, and is obviously thus fictional. But it encapsulates the insecurities, the awkwardness, the embarrassment that some men feel around women. The book is called Lonesome Dove, and it's by Larry McMurtry, the author of several Western classics, including The Last Picture Show. You might have seen the movie. Its main theme is the Lonesome Dove's theme is a monumental cattle drive, an epic journey from the Rio Grande north to Montana. And if you read only one Western novel in your life, read Lonesome Dove. I tell you what, it's as addictive as Yellowstone. And it's about as long. It's 750 pages. But I'm ripping through it. I mean, it's a sort of book that is so fat, you look at it and you think, well, the immediate instinct is to open it up and see how big the print is. And the print's quite small, and you think, goodness me, I will be reading this for a very long time. But I'm already halfway through it, and I only started reading it 10 days ago. That's partly because I don't have a TV and I can't watch Yellowstone. Set in the last American wilderness of the 1880s, it's a very different landscape from 2026 Britain, where women are so angry. Angry, taken for granted, misunderstood. Somewhere near his deathbed, the genius Stephen Hawking was reputed to have said that he had satisfactorily solved all scientific conundrums that were placed before him in his life, but that one mystery had eluded him. When asked what that was, he replied simply, women. Whether that was the last word he spoke, I don't know, but the genius Stephen Hawking had this unsolved mystery in common with a cowboy called P.I., that's P-E-A-I-E-Y-E, in Larry McMurtry's Lonesome Dove. Here, P in conversation with his friend and mentor, Gus, grapples with the idea of marrying the recently widowed Mary Cole. The fact that P had only spoken to Mary Cole five or six times in his life, most of them times when she was still married to Josh Cole, didn't mean a thing to a bystander like Gus, or even a bystander like Gus's friend Dietz. Both of them seemed to take it for granted that Mary regarded him as a fit successor to Josh. The thing that seemed to clinch it, in their view, was that while Mary was an unusually tall woman, she wasn't as tall as P. She'd been a good foot taller than her recently departed husband, Josh, a mild fellow who had been in Pickle's Gap buying a milk cow when a bad storm hit. A bolt of lightning fried both Josh and his horse. The milk cow had only been singed, but it still affected her milk. Mary Cole never remarried, but in Gus's view, that was only because P.I. had not the enterprise to walk down the street and ask her. "Why, Josh was just a half pint," Gus said frequently. "That woman needs a full pint. It'd be a blessing for her to have a man around who could reach the top shelf." P had never considered that height might be a factor in relations such as marriage. After brooding about it for several months, it occurred to him that Gus was tall too, and educated. "Hell, you're tall," he said one night. "You ought to marry her yourself. The both of you can read." He knew Mary could read because he'd been in church once or twice when the preacher had asked her to read the Psalms. She had a kind of low, scratchy voice, unusual in a woman. Once or twice listening to it made P feel funny, as if someone was tickling the little hairs on the back of his neck. Gus vehemently denied that he would be a suitable mate for Mary Cole. "Why, no, P, it wouldn't do," he said. I've been rung through the ring of marriage twice. "What a widow wants is someone fresh. That's what all women want, widows or not. If a man's got experience, it's bound to be that he got it with another woman, and that don't never sit well. A forthright woman like Mary probably considers that she can give you all the experience you're ever likely to need." To P, it was all just a troublesome puzzle. Some nights, lying on the porch, he felt a fool for even thinking about such things, and yet he did. He'd lived with men his whole life, rangering and working. During his whole adult life, he couldn't recollect spending more than 10 minutes alone with a woman. But some nights, Widow Cole would pop to the surface of his consciousness like a turtle on the surface of a pond. Even more persistent than the thought of her reading the Psalms was another memory. One day, he'd been passing her house just as a little thunderstorm swept through the town, scaring the dogs and cats and rolling tumbleweeds down the middle of the street. Mary had hung out a wash and was in her backyard trying to get it in before the rain struck and the thunderstorm proved too quick for her. Big drops of rain began to splatter in the dust, and the wind got higher, causing the sheets on Mary's clothesline to flap so hard they popped like guns. P had been raised to be helpful, and since it was obvious that Mary was going to have a hard time with the sheets, he started to offer his assistance. But the storm had a start on both of them, and before he even got there, the rain began to pour down, turning the white dust brown. Most women would have seen at that point that the wash was a lost cause and run for the house, but Mary wasn't running. Her skirt was already so wet it was plastered to her legs, but she was struggling with one of the flapping sheets. In the struggle, two or three small garments that she'd already gathered up blew out of her hand and across the yard, which had begun to look like a shallow lake. P hurried to retrieve the garments and then helped Mary get the wet sheet off the line. She was evidently just doing it out of pure stubbornness, since the sun was shining brightly to the west of the storm and would obviously be available to dry the sheets again in a few minutes. It was P's one close exposure to an aspect of womankind that Gus was always talking about. Their penchant for flying directly in the face of reason. Mary was as wet on the top as on the bottom, and the flapping sheet had knocked one of the combs out of her hair, causing it to come loose. The wash was as wet as it had been before she hung it up in the first place, and yet she wasn't quitting. She was taking the clothes off the line that would just have to be hung back on 15 minutes later, and P was helping her to do it, as if it all made sense. While he was steadying the clothesline, he happened to notice something that gave him almost as hard a jolt as the bolt of lightning that had killed Josh Cole. The clothes he had rescued were undergarments, white bloomers of the sort that it was obvious Mary was wearing beneath the skirt that was so wet against her legs. P was so shocked that he almost dropped the underpants back in the mud. She was bound to think it bold that he would pick up her undergarments like that. And yet, she was determined to have the sheets off the line, and all he could do was stand there, numb with embarrassment. It was a blessing that rain soon began to pour off his hat brim in streams right in front of his face, making a little waterfall for him to hide behind until the ordeal ended. With the water running off his hat, he only caught blurred glimpses of what was going on. He couldn't judge to what extent Mary had been shocked by his helpful but thoughtless act. To his surprise, nothing terrible happened. When she finally had the sheet under control, Mary took back the bloomers from him as casually as if they were handkerchiefs or table napkins or something. To his vast surprise, she seemed to be rather amused at the sight of him standing there in a stream of water, pouring off his hat, falling just in front of his nose. "P, it's a good thing that you know how to keep your mouth shut," she said. "If you'd opened it right now, you'd probably drown. Many thanks for your help." She was the kind of forthright woman who called men by their first names, and she was known to salt her speech rather freely with criticism. "We've the Lord to thank for this bath," she said. "I personally didn't need it, but I'm bound to say it might work an improvement where you're concerned. You ain't as bad looking as I thought, now that you're nearly clean." By the time she got back to her porch, the rain was slackening and the sun was already striking little rainbows through the sparkle of the drops that still fell. P walked on home, the water dripping more slowly from his hat. He never mentioned the incident to anyone, knowing it would mean unmerciful teasing if it ever got out. But he remembered it. When he lay on the porch half drunk and it floated up in his mind, things got mixed into the memory that he hadn't even known he was noticing, such as the smell of Mary's wet flesh. He hadn't meant to smell her and hadn't made any effort to, and yet the very night after it happened, the first thing he remembered was that Mary had smelled different from any other wet thing he'd ever smelled. He couldn't find a word for what was different about Mary's smell. Just that, it being a woman, she smelled cleaner than most of the wet things he'd come in contact with. It'd been more than a year since the rainstorm, and yet Mary's smell was still part of the memory of it. It was not every night he remembered Mary, though. Much of the time, he found himself wondering about the generalities of marriage. The principal aspect he worried over most was that marriage required men and women to live together. He tried many times to imagine how it would be to be alone at night under the same roof with a woman, or to have one there at breakfast and supper. What kind of talk would a woman expect? And what kind of behaviour? It stumped him. He couldn't even make a guess. Once in a while, it occurred to him that he could tell Mary he would like to marry her, but he didn't consider himself worthy to live under the same roof with her. If he put it right, she might take a liberal attitude and allow him to continue to live down the street with the boys. That would be good. That would be what he would be used to. He would plan, of course, to make himself available for chores when she required him. Otherwise, life could go on in its accustomed way. He was even tempted to sound out Gus on the plan. Gus knew more about marriage than anyone else. But every time he planned to bring it up, he either got sleepy first or decided at the last second he'd better keep quiet. If the plan was ridiculous in the eyes of an expert, then P wouldn't know what to think. And besides, Gus would never let up teasing.
En Camino with Kid Hogg.
On the land, but it is fed and watered.
Yes, welcome to the part of the show we call Things That Grow. Now, during the 40-odd years I've practiced tree surgery, 20 of them here on the Costa del Sol, I adopted a slogan, people and trees, la gente y los árboles. The concept being that trees have rights as well as their human neighbours, and that my role was a sort of mediator, such that people and trees might live together in harmony. But neighbours don't always get along, as we know, and neighbouring trees are no exception. Common complaints from potential clients are that trees block views. They give too much shade. Their roots lift patios, attack foundations, and in the case of algarrobos and palms, harbour rats, all of which are legitimate cause for human concern and a reason for judicious pruning. Extreme cases, felling. But there was one common complaint which I, as a tree lover, could not empathise with, which I felt was a sad reflection of that suburban attempt to treat one's garden as an extension of one's living room.
It makes a mess,
he or she would say in a slightly whingy way, to which I, with short shrift, would reply, well, it's a tree, isn't it? There were exceptions, occasions to evoke sympathy. I remember a couple of Australian women with a restaurant in Nueva Andalucía, tables on a terrace shaded by an umbrella-shaped ficus. Being a ficus, a member of the fig family, it produced small, squadgy fruits, which daily would splat and stain paving and white tablecloths. Annually, we would prune this tree to thin out fruit-bearing branches, but the future of the ficus hung very much in the balance. The advantage of its balmy shade weighed against the uphill task of sweeping and mopping its droppings. Like a pet that isn't house-trained, this tree puts me in mind of my own terrace, sweetly protected from the sun by a canopy of interwoven vine, kiwi fruit, orange and avocado, a cosseting glade of shade between the kitchen door and the swimming pool. This first summer in this house, this small Pueblo house that I've bought, coincides with a whole new insight into the lives of people who complained that their trees made a mess. It's as though each of the plants that cover my patio takes it in turn to shed something. Autumn, of course. Yeah, you understand autumn. It's the time for this. And the vine duly quite understandably complies by dumping all of its leaves in an ankle-deep mat. Okay, I cope with that once a year. Clear up the leaves. They come pretty much at once. Prune back the season's growth and let the winter sun into the kitchen. But then, in early spring, the avocado decides to replace its entire crown of leaves with new ones, more sweeping. Now the orange tree has joined in. Meanwhile, the vine is depositing tiny green filigrees of embryonic grapes. Oh, and not to be outdone, the kiwi, growing like a triffid, is prematurely discarding fruit, green ball-bearing-sized bubbles, onto tiles, chairs and tables. In exasperation, and as I puff, blow and sweep my terrace, sometimes three times in a day, I realise I've become one of those suburbanites whom I used to scorn, who, in failed attempt at domesticity, endeavours to colonise and control the great outdoors. And perhaps this is the challenge of gardening around a small terrace, the sometimes thankless task of imposing domesticity on nature. Oh, yeah. Did I mention my swimming pool? I've never had a swimming pool before. We've always swum in the river. But now I'm living in the Pueblo with a vegetation-splattered patio, next to which is a small swimming pool. No, it's not big, but it's definitely more than a plunge pool. It sat sad and empty during winter, filling with soggy vine leaves. I shoveled it out, cleaned it, painted it twice, and 2 weeks ago I filled it. It took about 10 hours to fill it, and then called Diego, the plumber, to fix the pump. Because a pool without a pump, it's an invitation to wildlife, as I'm sure you know if you've got a pool. But Diego, the plumber, wasn't answering. It later transpired that, being a plumber, regularly exposed to damp places, he dropped his mobile phone into one of them and was thus unreachable. Meanwhile, I began to notice signs of burgeoning pond life in the static, soon-to-be stagnant waters of my recently filled pool. In a reenactment of the first life on planet Earth, tiny creepy crawlies, transparent segmented organisms were evolving and procreating, hatching from larvae in the gradually greening waters. As well as birth, there was death. Wasps, flies, and bluebottles drowned, while sodden leaves blown in from the terrace accumulated, spiralling lazily to the floor of the pond. Did I say pond? No, it's a swimming pool. It was a far cry from the swimming pool culture of the endless refreshment in crystalline blue waters, droplets of diluted chlorine on sun-kissed skin reflecting Mediterranean light in a purity of benign chemical hygiene. Of course, I'd bought myself one of those fishing nets, one of those long poles with which to stir the nascent swamp. But I needed mechanical movement, something to do with aeration. I needed a functioning pump. Where was Diego? I found him strimming his finca. A lot of people are doing that at this time of year. It was then that he told me that he was trying to dry out his phone. It was partially dismembered on a sunny wall. No worries, I said. Look, I bought my diary. Give me a date, which he did. The pump works, but I'm still trying to cultivate the Zen space patience of fishing leaves, stalks and flowers from my messy trees that land in the water with the pole or net, or in rather less of a Zen way, diving in and wallowing around my swimming pool with a sieve to retrieve the debris. The swimming pool, that's the whole bunch of hassle for a fleeting moment of pleasure. Now then, Newsstream Intrigue reports that the proposal for the... Newsstream Intrigue reports that the proposal for the Strait of Gibraltar tunnel has raised its head once again. I don't know if you were ever familiar with this, those of us who live in the southwest of the Costa del Sol. It's a proposal that's been around for a long time. It's to build a tunnel from basically from Spain to Morocco. It's 60 kilometres, half underwater, and it would link Europe to Africa via a passenger and freight service between, wait for it, Tarifa's Punto de Paloma and Morocco's Malabata. Now, I don't know Morocco's Malabata, but I do know Tarifa's Punto de Paloma. It's actually my favourite beach. It's a beautiful beach, a crescent hemmed in by high dunes. It's a windsurf mecca, and there's all sorts of cool beach bars around it. It's the idea of that becoming the mouth of a tunnel to Morocco, it just sends shudders through my spine. Anyway, it's a big deal. It's a huge expense. It's circa $20 million US. But there's some big pushers. Morocco loves the idea of new access to the EU while positioning itself as Europe's gateway into Africa. And as for Spain, it de-risks supply chains across agriculture, phosphates and energy by cutting reliance on its slower, costlier, weather-dependent sea links. Worryingly, Madrid has just approved a €2 million budget for further studies on the project and its feasibility. Watch this space. And just when you thought that Iceland couldn't get any more peaceful, somehow it just did. A whole 2%. And that is according to the Global Peace Index, which Iceland, NATO's only member without a standing army, have now topped for the 19th year, the most peaceful place on Earth. They pipped other tranquil havens like New Zealand, Switzerland, Slovenia and Ireland, the top five most peaceful places on the planet, in a list that reads like a schedule for an ABBA farewell tour or something. But with overall global peace actually in decline for the 12th consecutive year amid more active conflicts than at any time since the Second World War, what is the secret for these here peaceniks? Well, it's location, location, location. Yes, geography seems to help. They all give that far from the chaos vibe, as far as New Zealand is concerned, particularly. But generally, these peaceful places are high trust democracies, societies of low corruption, decent neighbours, and an enviable quality of life. Flip those metrics, and what does the bottom line of the Global Peace Index look like? Well, it might not surprise you that propping up the table is Putin's Russia, behind Ukraine, the Congo and Sudan. The US is in the relegation zone in 134th position, behind China, which is in 118th. In 22nd place, Europe's biggest climber is Poland, up 23 places from last year, while Spain is up four places to become the 27th most peaceful country in the world, in spite of quite how noisy it can be. Meanwhile, down seven places, the UK is in 39th position, behind Albania, Uzbekistan and Equatorial Guinea. Well, there we are. That's the Peace League for this year. I'm wishing you a very peaceful weekend. Thank you for being with me for the last hour. I hope you've enjoyed it. I certainly have. Look forward to seeing you next week. Have a very happy weekend. Bye-bye now.
You've been listening to a TRE production. If you've enjoyed this program, there'll be another episode waiting for you next week, right here on this platform, where you can also access our extensive back catalogue of shows and interviews. For more information on our live programming, social media channels and apps, and how to contact Talk Radio Europe, please visit tre.radio.